According to new research, the cost of caring for a person with autism could top $2.4 million in that individual's lifetime. This hour, we discuss what factors are at play, and we answer your questions about the diagnosis and treatment of autism. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:07 on Thursday, June 12th. Are you caring for someone with autism or know someone who is? What has that experience been like? We'd like to hear your story and answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. My guests today are Dr. Maria Stanley, the Medical Director of the Weizmann Center and Clinical Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Stanley, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning.
And Maureen Durkin, she is an epidemiologist and a professor of population health sciences at the UW-Madison. Professor Durkin, thanks for joining us as well.
Good morning, Cynthia.
Well, the new research says that the cost of supporting someone with autism could cost as much as $2.4 million over the course of their lifetime. What are some of the biggest contributors to that cost? I guess I'll start with you, Dr. Stanley.
The paper that came out actually found that the two biggest costs that were associated were special education services for people during childhood and residential care in adulthood for people who required residential care.
And I know that there are some variables to that cost depending on some certain factors. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I think autism, one of the things about autism is that it's so different for every individual. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that there is a huge range for any given individual in terms of their needs. And some people with autism, particularly, and this study particularly highlighted that those who have comorbid intellectual disability, which we used to call mental retardation, have particularly high needs, and that those people have significantly higher costs associated with their care. And that makes sense because we know that people who have intellectual disability have more challenges, and so. You know, I think that that's one of the things in terms of the variability or the differences. That's one of the factors. And in fact, there was about that 2.4 million number was specifically for the folks who have associated intellectual disability, and about 70% of people who have autism spectrum disorders do not have intellectual disabilities, and the cost for those folks was about $1 million less lifetime cost.
Mm-hmm. And Maureen Durkin, what about you? What was your take on these numbers? Was it at all surprising or a confirmation of something you already were aware of?
I think that it does confirm what previous research in this area shows, that autism is really one of the most costly types of developmental disability because of the near total dependence often on individuals with autism for care throughout their lifespan and the intensity of services needed. And the costs are borne by society as a whole and also by the families. There's been studies showing that families of children with autism spend more out of pocket for different types of treatments and services than any other types of developmental disability.
In what ways does society also bear the cost of autism?
Well, I think this study shows the cost of special education and during childhood, that and the lost income on the part of parents, their lost productivity because of the extra needs of caring for a child with autism. And those are costs society bears.
Well, let's take a step back just a little bit for anybody who still might be unclear on what exactly autism is. Could you describe it for us, Dr. Stanley?
So autism again, there's a huge range of how autism can look for any individual. But basically, autism involves deficits or differences in social and communication skills, and also unusual restricted or repetitive behaviors or interests. And again, how it looks in any individual can vary, you know, and we see people who have no verbal skills and severe challenges, and we also see people who are very high functioning and very intelligent people who are ultimately able to be great contributors to society. So and again, you know, I think all people have a contribution to make in society, but I think it's just it's important to understand that there's a huge range of what we see in autism.
Mm-hmm. And Maureen, in your work, what kinds of things are you investigating at the Waisman Center?
Well, we are one of the sites for the CDC's, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Autism and Developmental Disabilities Surveillance System. So we've been monitoring the prevalence of autism among children in Wisconsin since 2002.
Okay.
And demonstrating that every year that we measure it, it seems to be going up in recent years.
And why is that?
Well, we don't know, and that's one of the things we're looking into, but there's no doubt that there's greater awareness now of autism than there was in the past, and there's better tools for measuring it. Pediatricians now routinely screen to all children for autism at various developmental stages, and so some of it is likely due to better recognition, awareness, and detection. There's other factors that might be contributing to the increase as well. And one of those that we've looked at is the age of parenting. The age at which parents are having their first child has been going up steadily over the decades, and that is also associated with an increased risk of autism.
Is that so? Why do we have any idea why?
Well, we don't know. I mean, there are theories about it. There's genetic mechanisms that could account for some of it. The risks of all kinds of adverse neurodevelopmental outcomes increases with maternal age, and that's been known for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So although you might be getting better at recognizing it, diagnosing it, and even treating it, have we made any headway in so far as finding a cause for it?
We're not a huge amount. I would say for the most part, autism is still of unknown etiology. We don't think it's one specific cause. It's probably multiple disorders, and there's genetic mechanisms that lead to autism. There's a lot of interest now in whether some of the environmental exposures during pregnancy and early in development might be affecting the brain in ways that leads to autism, but no firm answers on these yet.
We're talking with Maureen Durkin. She's a professor of population health sciences at the UW-Madison. And we're also joined by Dr. Maria Stanley, medical director of the Waisman Center and clinical associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Affairs. We're talking about autism this hour, what we know about it, what we have yet to learn, and we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about autism? Do you care for someone who has autism, and what's that experience been like? Are you surprised at all to hear about the cost of care over one's lifetime? We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org or find us on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about autism this hour and taking your questions and comments about it at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also find us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. We're talking with Maria Stanley. She's medical director of the Waisman Center and clinical associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and Maureen Durkin. She's professor of population health sciences at the UW-Madison. Dr. Stanley, tell us a little bit about some of the tools that are used to diagnose autism. How do you go about making a final diagnosis about it?
So the initial screening for autism, as Dr. Durkin was saying, usually happens in the pediatrician's office. And that's often just a quick pencil and paper kind of questionnaire that families can complete and can help to identify kids who are at risk. Pediatricians are also doing ongoing developmental surveillance and watching and listening to parents for signs and symptoms of an autism spectrum disorder. And then typically there would be a next level of evaluation to try to understand if somebody who had concerns on a screening assessment might truly have an autism spectrum disorder. And so the next level of evaluation typically involves a comprehensive developmental and health history, and also a review of medical issues and a medical exam, as well as a standardized diagnostic instrument that has been validated for making a diagnosis of an autism spectrum disorder. And then all that information is put together to try to understand whether the concerns that are presenting really fit with the diagnosis of autism.
Did you say there's an instrument that's used?
So yeah, and maybe that was an unfortunate wording in terms of that wouldn't be easily understandable by everyone. So basically, it's a diagnostic tool, but the tool is typically just involves sitting down and interacting with the person that's being evaluated. And for very young children, it's very play-based and involves doing things like blowing bubbles and playing with toys. But what we're really looking at is how a person or a child uses their social and communication skills and how they relate to the person that's doing the assessment. And so how they're making eye contact, how they're coordinating their eye contact with gestures. We're looking for things like ability to engage in pretend play and really how another person gets drawn into the world of the person that's being assessed. So saying an instrument probably doesn't quite capture all of those things. For an older person, typically it's more of an interview form, but it's conversational. And again, we're looking at how a person is able to engage in a back and forth conversation, how they're able to describe social relationships, and it's continuing to look at things like eye contact and gesture, and all of those things together can help us understand, is this a person who really has challenges in the social and communication realm? And then we're also looking during the assessment, is that child or even adult exhibiting repetitive behaviors, repetitive speech, pretty intense focus on a particular topic or interest, or is that person more able to ask about the interests of, say, the person that is doing the interview? And so all of those things help us look at the concerns that are being evaluated.
What are some related conditions that someone with autism might be also exhibiting alongside the condition of autism itself?
So there is a large range, and again, I think that the path to autism is can vary, and so some of the people that we see have had pretty significant newborn or around the time of birth issues. For example, some of the children have had extreme prematurity or other pretty serious health complications in the newborn period, and so they may have a lot of medical issues that are related to that. We see people who have either clearly identified genetic syndromes such as Down syndrome or Fragile X syndrome who are at higher risk for having an autism spectrum disorder. And then other less known genetic conditions, and we know that there's a fairly significant genetic contribution to autism spectrum disorders. And then, as we were talking earlier, intellectual disability is a factor for many people who are on the autism spectrum. And then we see a range of other challenges for people on the autism spectrum, such as, you know, there's a higher risk for things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, a higher risk of anxiety, and especially in teens and adulthood, a higher risk of depression.
Why is that?
It's a challenging condition to live mm-hmm. with, and I think that the world can be very hard for a person who's on the autism spectrum. We haven't, as a society, fully figured out how to celebrate and include people who have a range of different developmental issues, including autism spectrum disorders, and you know, and we see, particularly in adulthood, and I think that the study that you mentioned at the top of the show highlighted this, that under or unemployment is a huge issue for adults on the autism spectrum. So people who don't have intellectual disability still not being fully employed, and that's, you know, for anybody, that would contribute to an increased risk for depression.
Maureen, I wanted to ask you, you said that as the science starts to kind of catch up to autism and you're getting better at diagnosing it, I'm wondering if there are chances that there might be some undiagnosed, perhaps adults, that have autism, and what maybe are some signs for recognizing that?
I'm sure there are undiagnosed because we are diagnosing it more, so there's cohort effects in this respect. There have been a study in England where they did screen adults for autism, and they found that the prevalence was just about the same in adults as it was in children, about 1% in that study. I think some of the core features of autism are difficulties with social communication, social interaction, reading social cues, and things like that, which can have enormous effects on adults' ability to find work and participate in the workforce and also in other societal institutions, marriage and family and things like that. So the effects can be very pervasive throughout the lifespan.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Maureen Durkin, Professor of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison, and Maria Stanley. She is Medical Director of the Weizmann Center and Clinical Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Affairs. And they're taking your questions and your experiences with autism at 1-800-642-1234. Are you someone caring for someone with a developmental disability, or is the cost of the caring for someone with autism in line with what you've been experiencing? 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. At what age should children first be screened for autism, Dr. Stanley?
The American Academy of Pediatrics has some very clear recommendations about screening for autism spectrum disorders. And as far as administering a standardized screening tool, which I mentioned earlier, that kind of quick little questionnaire that a family could fill out, the first time that it's recommended to have screening is at 18 months at a well-child visit. And then again, at age 24 months, screening is recommended because there are a significant number of children who might not be identified if we only do a single screening.
So I'm wondering, there are some people who still contend that that vaccinations have something to do with the onset of autism. What have scientific research studies since that first allegation came about, what have they shown?
Study after study has not identified any link between autism spectrum disorders and vaccinations. There just was another large study published out of Australia, but I think this has been looked at countries around the world. people, you know, people who give vaccinations, pediatricians, are very concerned that they're not doing something that would harm children. There had been initially some focus on thimerosal, which is a preservative in vaccines that was used in vaccines in the past, as a potential culprit. That has been removed from almost all vaccines and from all the routine childhood vaccines at this point, with the exception of one. And it hasn't changed the incidence of autism. And so I think that, you know, the science has not borne that out.
Mm-hmm. And Maureen, is that still something that you find you need to bust some myths about when you're working with clients?
Well, I think definitely there's still some people there that are worried that it could be related to autism. And one of the problems that we've seen now is a reemergence of some of the infectious diseases that had been almost eliminated from the population. We're seeing, I think, the largest number of measles cases in the United States has occurred last year. Mm-hmm. Since the 60s or something. So that it really has affected vaccination rates around the country, and we're hoping that this will change as better awareness that had nothing to do with autism. And the original study claiming there was a link has also been withdrawn because it was shown to be fraudulent. And I'm afraid that word hasn't gotten out as much as some of the fears that have been spread.
Yeah. We're talking with Maureen Durkin, Professor of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, and Maria Stanley, Medical Director of the Weissman Center in Madison, about autism. You can call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. We'll be right back after the news. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. New research suggests the cost of treating someone with autism could reach as high as $2.4 million during that person's lifetime. And there's a lot yet we don't know or understand about autism. But we're talking with two people today who are telling us what we do know and answering your questions. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:36 on Thursday, June 12th. You can get in touch with us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can also tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. My guests are Maria Stanley, Medical Director of the Weissman Center, and Clinical Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and Maureen Durkin. She's a Professor of Population Health Sciences and Pediatrics at the UW-Madison. Let's take a call first from Mike in Iowa. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And what's your question or comment?
Oh, when we had our first son and he was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, a lot of people said they felt really bad for us, but it didn't really bother me, because when you have a child, you bear such a love for them that whatever happens to them, it doesn't change how you feel about them.
Yeah. And what's your experience been like so far? Has it been costly?
Yeah, we've had to take him to specialists, and he's in his own, he has his own IEP, and he goes to different classes and stuff, and we're trying to see if he can stay with kids his age and all that. Mm-hmm. But his younger brother sometimes doesn't go up to his own potential because he likes to imitate his older brother.
Interesting. Thanks for that call, Mike. Maureen, can you talk a little bit about that, the family dynamics that might be at play when there's a child with autism?
Sure. I think that the caller brings up an important issue, and something that this study that we're talking about today that measured the cost of autism did not measure the full impact of the condition on the other family members, and it really just monitored the monetary costs. But there's been many studies now showing that the impacts on other members of the family can be very important, and on, as well as the parents working and things like that. So And I think the caller also brought up a common theme that you hear from parents, which is that they completely value the child, whether they have autism or not, and wish to see them become full participants in society. And so I think many of the services nowadays are intended to help facilitate that.
And Maria Stanley, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I would agree, and I just really appreciated hearing that comment, because I think that's so important. You know, I think it's easy to talk about a condition like autism in the abstract, but these are people who are loved and important members of society, and I think that's really important to highlight.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-642-1234. Let's talk a little bit more about treatments. You've listed a number of symptoms and other related conditions of those who have autism. And I'm wondering, when it comes to treating autism, is it more about treating the symptoms and side effects, or are we really getting at the heart of autism?
So, I think the answer is we're not there yet in terms of really understanding what makes the biggest impact on long-term prognosis and outcomes for people with autism spectrum disorders. And I think that there are a range of interventions that can happen throughout the lifespan to help support people in optimal success. What we do know is that there's a growing evidence base supporting early intensive interventions, and we're fortunate in the state of Wisconsin that there is both an insurance mandate that compels insurance companies to cover intensive autism services for young children, and also that there's a waiver program in this state for people who don't have a kind of insurance that would be covered under the mandate to help cover those early intensive services, because they're really, like I said, there's growing evidence that really is one of the things that can make a huge difference. And when we're talking about the cost of autism spectrum disorders, one of the things that I think it brings up is how could that be changed? How could we make a difference? And because, and if we can early on do something to change the course of a person's life and help them be more integrated and into society and more successful and more able to be a working and productive adult, that changes that cost trajectory enormously. But it often involves an early upfront investment. The treatments that are available aren't isolated to young children. I think we need more evidence around what kind of special education supports really make a difference. I think that a lot of times schools are having to, each school district is having to in some ways create their own system for providing appropriate supports for people with autism, but I don't think we have one coherent view of long-term over the course of a child's education, what's going to make the biggest impact, and we still need a lot of research in that area. We know that there are supports that can be put in place in adolescence and adulthood around transition to adulthood to help people prepare for higher education or for employment, and there are things that can be done to help build success in that area. We have a researcher here who's been at the Waisman Center who has developed a program called Transitioning Together, and that provides support both for teens with autism spectrum disorders and for their family members in terms of helping them. And it really has been identified as making a difference. And now the researcher, Leanne Smith, who's responsible for that program, is trying to help distribute distributed and make it available through high schools around the country, and we're working to make that available as a clinical service here at the Waisman Center as well. And then, you know, in adulthood, what, you know, I think we don't understand exactly what needs to happen to help people be and remain successful in the workplace. And so I think we need, you know, there is so much research that we still need to understand what things we can do to help provide support and help really make a difference in the lives of people who have autism spectrum disorders and their families.
And Maureen, I wanted to give you a chance to respond as well if you had any additional information.
Sure. Yeah, I think that just to echo one of the points made by Dr. Stanley about the investment we're making in special education, if you apply the numbers from this new study about the cost of autism to Wisconsin, we would estimate that we're spending about over $400 million a year just on children in providing special education and early interventions to children. But we don't have good information on what we're getting for that investment. We don't know what the outcomes are, whether we're really making a difference, whether the services are being provided to those in greatest need. And there's also, it's important because most of what we do now for autism is focused on the childhood period. And so once a child leaves school, there's very little in the way of supports or services to ensure that they can participate fully in the workforce. Mm-hmm.
Let's take a call quickly from Mike in Hazel Green. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I had a quick question. I'm a psychology student, a foster parent. I have some experience working with autism, and I noticed between the diagnostic manuals, the fourth edition and the fifth edition, they've eliminated some of the diagnosis for the higher end of the spectrum, like Asperger's syndrome, and sort of lumped it all together. And I'm wondering how the doctor feels this is going to affect the treatment of people on that end of the spectrum, and if they're going to be left by the wayside, perhaps, or treated better. And if they could comment to that, I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Mike. That's a good question. What about that, Dr. Stanley?
So that is a very good question, and I think there has been a flurry of controversy surrounding the change in diagnostic criteria. The previous DSM or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that defines autism or autism spectrum disorder had three separate conditions listed under that umbrella of pervasive developmental disorders, which included a condition called PDD-NOS or pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, Asperger's syndrome, and then autistic disorder. There was a decision made in the newest version to eliminate those other categories and just call them all autism spectrum disorder. Part of it was because it turned out that there wasn't the diagnosis, particularly of Asperger's syndrome, was not very solid, and it turned out that the thing that most determined whether a person might get that diagnosis is where which center made the diagnosis, and so that wasn't a very strong support for that as a separate diagnostic category. And I think there was some thought that some recognition that people on any part of the autism spectrum still required some additional services and supports. The worry when that changed, though, was that what it might lead to is people not being diagnosed who are on the higher end of the spectrum. And I think there have been, you know, I don't think that the final answer is in. There are studies, conflicting studies coming out trying to describe whether that's actually happening now or not. There was a lot of work done in advance of the new diagnostic criteria to help to try to understand was that going to happen. One of the things that the new diagnostic criteria did say was that anybody who already has a diagnosis on the autism spectrum, so again, whether it's pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified or Asperger or autistic disorder, all of those people should currently be defined as having an autism spectrum disorder, so they didn't need to be re-diagnosed. And so it didn't change the diagnosis for anybody who already had one. I would say our experience here at the Waisman Center, we do many, many, many diagnostic assessments, and we don't find here that it has significantly changed diagnosis, or that we're seeing a large number of people who would have met criteria under the old diagnostic criteria who aren't currently meeting criteria for the new with the new definitions of autism.
That's Maria Stanley. She's medical director of the Waisman Center and clinical associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're talking with Maureen Durkin, professor of population health sciences at the UW-Madison. We're talking about autism this hour and taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about autism this hour with a couple of guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email your questions at talk@wpr.org. Talking with Maria Stanley, medical director of the Waisman Center in Madison, and with Maureen Durkin, a professor of population health sciences and pediatrics at UW-Madison. Let's take a call next from Michelle in Stevens Point. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Excuse me. Hi. Hello?
Yep. What's your question?
It's not really a question. It's a comment. I'm a school psychologist in Stevens Point, and I just want to emphasize the point, I guess, that individuals on the autism spectrum disorder are very much individuals, and we can, you know, in my school, for example, we have one student who is barely able to communicate, another who is very high functioning, and so our interventions are very different. There's a saying, something to the effect of, you've met one student or one person on the autism spectrum, you've met one person on the autism spectrum, because there is such a variety within that spectrum that it's difficult to even think about them as a whole, and which makes them, you know, often more complicated in terms of when you think about interventions that will work and how they present. And that's my only point. And I thank both presenters for the excellent work they're doing. I refer many families to the Waisman Center. And thanks for having this topic on the program.
Sure. Thanks, Michelle. Maureen, how do you ensure that every patient is getting personalized care?
Well, I just think that Michelle points out very well one of the reasons for the high costs, I think, of autism treatment and intervention is that we don't have a one-size-fits-all type of treatment for it, and it does require a lot of very individualized one-on-one assessment and intervention to make sure the child or the adult is receiving the interventions they need to enhance their own functioning.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call next from Pam in Milwaukee. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I'm a grandmother, and I have an 11-year-old grandson that I believe is on the autism spectrum. Two professionals in that field that work in schools and senior homes have agreed that he does exhibit those kinds of behaviors. School academically, he's doing very well. Socially, very poor. And I'm wondering, I can't convince his parents to have him professionally diagnosed. The school did do a analysis of him and simply came back with attention deficit disorder. But he does exhibit a lot of the autistic things, including flapping of the hands when he's extremely excited, that sort of thing. Anyway, my point is, I'm wondering if there's anything out there that I might be able to read that would allow me to help him get through social problems that he sometimes has. Yesterday, he offended somebody that is no longer a friend, and he was quite upset about it. And he won't talk to me about it. He won't tell me what he did. He does seem to recognize that he did something inappropriate, but I can't get him to share.
Okay, thank you, Pam. I'll let Maureen respond to that first, then we'll get Dr. Stanley's input.
Sure. Only thing I would point out is at the Wasteman Center, we have a resource center that provides information to people throughout the state of Wisconsin, and it points you to resources that you, both things you could read as well as where you might get a diagnosis and things like that, or an assessment for autism. And I did send the website for that to the producer, so I think you could distribute that on the website. And I don't know if Dr. Stanley probably wanted to add something.
Absolutely. So, a couple of things. One is I think that, it is possible to get support in the area of social skills, which is often around the age that you're discussing, starts to be more of a challenge. Social interactions become more nuanced and complex as people get older, and also it's more, those social connections become more and more important as kids get older, but also more complicated. There are in communities social skills groups, and local regional centers or resource centers are a great resource. We have a resource center here at the Wasteman Center, but there are several resource centers around the state, and there is one in your area in the Milwaukee area as well, the Southeast Regional Center, and I'm just looking at that phone number. It's 1-800-234-KIDS or 234-5437, and that those regional centers are an enormous resource in terms of trying to identify things in local communities that are available for people who have a range of different special needs. And often will serve people even without an identified specific diagnosis. I think it, what you're talking about also raises the question about why for somebody who is bright and maybe functioning well academically in a school setting, why would it matter to pursue additional diagnostic assessment if that person is doing well academically? And it's for exactly the reasons that you mentioned, that often the social component is the real challenge, and that if that can be identified, often that's a tool to advocate for services in the school setting to get appropriate support around those social skills. And many schools do offer a range of supports for people who are on the autism spectrum who need social skills support.
We only have just under a minute left. Maureen, I'm wondering, given the progress that we've made so far in understanding autism, are you optimistic that soon we'll be able to find a cause and a cure?
I think that this study on the cost of autism really raised awareness and put the spotlight on it. We need, without this information, maybe we might be able to ignore the problem, the frequency of autism. But now that we know what we're paying for it and how prevalent it is, it just points to the need to figure out how to prevent autism and how to be sure that what we're doing is improving the outcomes for people that do have autism.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Maureen Durkin, professor of population health sciences, and Maria Stanley. She's medical director of the Wasteman Center and clinical associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Thanks to Robin Cherry for producing and directing the hour, and Christy Taylor for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.